This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Jean Beeman from Purdue University. Jean is the author of Citizen Outsider, Children of North African Immigrants in France, with the University of California Press. Thank you for joining us, Jean.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us about Citizen Outsider. What's the book about? What are its big take-home ideas?
Yeah, so what the book is about is basically the title. Essentially, it's based on an ethnographic research I did in Paris of children of North African immigrants in France who are middle class and upwardly mobile compared to their immigrant parents. And I use the term citizen outsider to capture how they're technically or sort of legally part of French society, yet kept on the outside or the margins, if you will, of main society because of their ethnic origins. And I've sort of been fascinated by this question in France for a while, because France is such an interesting society because it doesn't acknowledge race and ethnicity as sort of salient identity categories, right, yet still marks particular individuals like the people I studied as different, as non-white, and therefore non-French. Mm. So my book is really sort of wrestling with, talking about how these individuals wrestle with that.
And how did they wrestle with it? Like, what, you know, first of all, how did they fare, the children of North African immigrants? Was the weight of bias heavier than it is here? Was it the same? Can you not compare them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a question I get a lot, and I usually try to skirt it, which I'll do right now. One of the things I talk about in my book is how a lot of the experiences of this minority population are very similar to experiences of, you know, African Americans and other racial and ethnic minorities in the United States, and then just sort of racial and ethnic minorities in other plural societies. And so I say that to say that, you know, while state level organizations matter, or sort of organizations in terms of identity politics, there's a lot of sort of commonality in how people experience what it's like to be marginalized solely because of your race or ethnic origin. So, for example, I talk about how for many of my respondents, they have experienced various difficulties working as the only sort of, you know, non-white person in their workplace, or, you know, being marginalized in public spaces. So this kind of goes back to, I think, the Starbucks example, sort of this idea of constantly being questioned as to whether or not they're in the right place or whether or not they belong, you know, not being able to, you know, take taxis, being searched on the subway, these sorts of things. So I talk about sort of the accumulation of these sort of everyday occurrences that are solely based on the fact that they're not seen as white by other French people.
I have kind of a story and then a question. So the story is, you know, a couple of years ago, I was in Paris and I was having dinner with my friend and a bunch of his friends. And then afterwards, he's telling me like, oh, so-and-so, you know, he actually did this and that thing. And I'm like, which one was he? He's like, oh, yeah, the North African guy. And I'm like, which one was that? Yeah. You know, because as an American, you know, people say, like, I don't see race, but we all know that's bullshit. But like, as an American, I honestly can't see the difference between a Frenchman and a North African necessarily, you know, especially somebody from like maybe the south of France. You know, I can't necessarily tell the difference because it's just not a salient distinction to me. Right. It's not something that I can recognize by sight. So it's kind of interesting. You're saying that France has this, you know, kind of like, you know, Republican civic nationalism thing of not acknowledging race. But obviously it is salient to the extent that, you know, things that to an American are not salient distinctions. You know, I honestly couldn't tell which guy he was talking about because that's not the kind of. And in the same way, I could imagine that if he were to have dinner at my house and he might say like, oh, which guy was that? I'm like, oh, yeah, my Mexican buddy. You know, he might not be able to tell which of my friends was Mexican, but that is a salient distinction to Americans. And then kind of the question is, before we get any further, can you define North African? Does it just mean that your grandfather lived somewhere in the Maghreb, or does it mean specifically, like, would a pied noir be considered a North African? Would a Jew be considered a North African? Or is it only Muslims from the Maghreb?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I use the term Maghrebin, or the French term for people from the Maghreb, interchangeably with North African in my book, just for a variety of sort of more political reasons. But yeah, so basically the way I define it is people who have a descendant or a parent from one of the former French colonies in the Maghreb versus the Maghreb in and of itself.
And do pied noir count in that?
So I don't count pied noir in that.
Can you tell me what pied noir is for those of us who aren't attuned?
Okay, so I'm really focusing on people who descended from being colonized in Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia. So I'm not focusing on sort of, you know, soldiers who settled in the Maghreb and later had kids there. I'm focusing on people who are direct descendants of people who grew up in these countries that then moved to France and had children of their own. And then I studied the children as they became adults or as adults.
So ethnic French who spent a generation or two in the Maghreb and then came back to France after the Algerian War don't count, basically.
Yeah.
Interesting. Do Jews count? Did you have Jews in your sample?
I don't have Jews in my sample.
My wife is a North African Jew. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, part of that was just because of the way that I recruited my sample, which is I used snowball sampling. So that was, and so I encountered people or sort of recruited people through a variety of different associations and professional networks. And so I think that that's why it was much more of a homogenous group in that sense.
Oh, sorry. And also too, Joe, I mean, like France is having its own troubles with anti-Semitism right now. And so how do you disentangle, like if there is a problem, how much of it would be because you're North African versus being Jewish?
Well, there's much more of backlash against Muslims, right? I think you're probably better off being Jewish than Muslim in the current political environment. Though, but what do I know about France?
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the things I talk about in my book, though, is how Muslim has sort of become the accepted category of otherness or difference within France. And so, yeah, there is a huge problem with anti-Semitism within France. But what I think what's interesting in terms of thinking about media accounts is that that's rare. Framed as something that's sort of happening to people who aren't seen as French, whereas, you know, attacks on mosques, for example, or other sort of Islamophobic incidents within France tend to be framed as against a population that is rejecting France or rejecting being, right? So I think that the framing is not so much, I think the framing is what's meaningfully different here.
Yeah, and I think another thing, Jean, just on that point, is I think that all of the media stories that I've seen coming out of France focusing on anti-Semitism in France, the stories all say, yeah, and the perpetrators of these anti-Semitic attacks are all Muslim. So that's another thing that I find quite interesting.
That's an excellent point. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's not comparable. The Islamophobia is like at a fever pitch both there and here. I would.
But Joe, I think part of the point I'm trying to make is I think part of the ways in which you see Islamophobia actually playing out is the way in which all anti-Semitism in France is now being blamed on Muslims. When you're like, are you serious?
Do they feel integrated? Or do they feel French? Or is there an attachment to the community or some type of sense of closure on their own? Like, is it a question of your subjects? They felt French, but French society was rejecting them? Or what was their embrace of French culture?
Yeah, I mean, so that was kind of one of the things that was in some ways most surprising when I was doing my field work is that a lot of my respondents identify or see themselves as French. They just perceive that everyone doesn't see them as French, right? So that's the sort of tension. So it's less between, you know, for example, am I French or am I Algerian? It's more, I see myself as French, but no one accepts that I am French. I have to say that I'm, you know, French of Algerian origin or these sorts of things. So it's sort of like similar to what we have in the United States of this idea of the perpetual foreigner syndrome. A similar thing is happening among the folks that I talk to who, you know, were born in France and have spent their whole lives in France, but are just never fully accepted as being French. And so it sort of becomes a question of like, well, where do you go from there?
Yeah, that resonates with what I see of our Muslim students here at Queen's College. Like, these kids are just Americans. But I have a question because I feel like that othering of Muslims is not strong in places where people have actual experience or interactions with Muslim. Like, the othering comes from places where there aren't Muslims and it's communicated to us through the media. That's my sense. I'm naive on that on many levels. But do you feel like that is similar in France? Like, does it come from everyday interactions in Paris? Or does it come from a media that might be parroting sort of exaggerated views that come from the countryside where people don't actually interact with North Africans?
Can I say both? Yeah, so a couple of thoughts on that. I mean, I think, yeah, the media representations play a big role. But I think also And what I think is maybe particular or somewhat special about the case of the second generation Maghreb immigrants as compared to other sort of ethnic minorities is that I think this also operates in a context in which France doesn't want to acknowledge its colonial history, and particularly in Algeria. And so I think that there's a way in which like the population I study are more sort of visible reminders that like, oh, this awful thing happened not too long ago. And so that's part of the sort of stigma that they experience every day.
You know, on that point, you know, that kind of reminds me of John Ogbu's work before he went crazy with his like acting white hypothesis with synecdoche fordham, right?
I didn't know that was the actual term for what happened.
What is that? Can you just, it sounds great and I know nothing of it. Could you just give me 2 seconds of what it is?
So Ogbu, John Ogbu, who's I think a Nigerian born anthropologist who, you know, became very famous through his academic work here in the United States. When he was trying to explain why it was that certain ethnic groups do better and seem to thrive in schools more than others, he conducted this like huge, like global study. And what he found was that we need to make a distinction between what he called voluntary and involuntary migrants. So for example, he shows that in Japan, Korean immigrants there do really poorly in school, right? But in the United States, Korean immigrants do really well, right? In France, Haitian immigrants do really poorly, right? But for a time in the United States, especially, you know, not so much in Florida, but like in a lot of other parts of the United States, Haitian immigrants did really well. He basically seems to be seeing as a pattern of people who migrate to countries in which they've had this history of being colonized from do very poorly, right? And people from those same countries who go to another country in which they don't have that past, right? And if, you know, trying to control for things like, well, this was your level, your parents' level of education before you migrated, et cetera, they seem to thrive in countries in which they don't have this history of colonization with. And so what's really unclear to me, and maybe kind of unclear to Ogbu as well, is what explains that. So how much of it is sort of like this kind of like internalization of, you know, of this past of having been colonized by those who migrate, and how much of it is this idea of inferiority of these people who were formerly colonized by the people in the receiving country. So what do you think, Jean?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that in reference to that particular Ogbu part. I think what's also kind of interesting, sort of related to that, is what are the national narratives or state level narratives about these colonial histories? Mm-hmm. What I think is so interesting about France, or one of the things I think is so interesting about France, like a lot of things are interesting about France, is that they sort of, you know, many of the folks I talked to didn't learn about, anything related to the French colonial empire in school, right? And so they had this sort of knowledge passed on from older relatives, but that's not something that was sort of integral as part of like, this is what it means to learn French history in schools. And so I wonder if that's also part of what explains this distinction as well.
I had a thought on what Leslie's saying, which is what I was hearing from you is mostly like almost like psychological mechanisms or cultural mechanisms. But in general, there's a very basic dynamic for immigration and success in the receiving country, which is that the harder it is to get there, the better you do if you do get there. That doesn't necessarily have anything to do with kind of like, you know, cultural legacies or perceptions of colonization or anything like that. It's just simply if a receiving country makes it very difficult for people from a particular sending country to arrive, then you're only going to get the elites from that sending country. And if a particular receiving country makes it very easy for people from a particular sending country to arrive, then you're going to get everybody, including those who aren't going to do as well. Now, a colonial history could be one important mechanism for that, right? So if either through explicit policy or just implicitly as kind of a natural outgrowth of various other policies, it's easier for people from the former colonial dependencies to migrate, then you're going to have a weak gradient. If you don't have that, you're probably more likely to have a strong gradient. You know, and we can see this in cases that don't involve colonization of the sending country by the receiving country. So for instance, African migrants, sub-Saharan African migrants in the United States do extremely well. They're some of the highest performing ethnic groups in the United States. And that's because it's almost impossible to migrate to the United States from sub-Saharan Africa. So we just get a bunch of PhDs and MDs. That's not self-selection entirely, because there's plenty of people with lower levels of education who would like to come here, but we don't let them.
Oh yeah, that's fair.
Whereas in Europe, it's fairly easy to get there from Africa. Not that I would want to do it, but you know, basically you walk or drive across the continent, you arrive in Libya and you get on a rubber boat and you got there until the Italian Navy picks you up. So it's much easier to get to Italy or France or Germany from sub-Saharan Africa than it is to get to the United States from sub-Saharan Africa. You know, not surprisingly, sub-Saharan African migrants do very well in the United States and do pretty poorly in Europe, because they're different people. We're only getting their people with graduate degrees, and the Europeans are getting sub-Saharan Africans, you know, with less than a high school education.
I mean, I think that might explain part of the variation, but I don't even think that that explains the bulk of it, right? So, you know, I like the case in point that I think about is migrants from the Anglophonic Caribbean. You know, if you think about the experience of migrants from the Anglophonic Caribbean to England in the 1950s, for example, I mean, it was really easy for them to get there, right? But they were subject to a lot of discrimination, regardless of their level of education, right?
Well, context of perception matters a lot. You know, I mean, that's another big part of the migration literature is context of perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
But you still have the selection thing. And I don't know, I'm just thinking, like, if you're thinking in terms of like these almost like psychological notions, that implies that, like, let's say that you have two Jamaicans with the same level of education, and one of them moves to England in 1955 and another moves to the United States in 1955. You're kind of implying that the Jamaican who moves to the United States would do noticeably better.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, although the United States did have colonial possessions, it didn't have Jamaica.
Yep.
Whereas Britain did. You know, I think it's entirely possible that that person might do better in America than they did in Britain for that reason. But I'm thinking that that's going to be a relatively small proportion of the variance compared to just, you know, how selected was the migration stream.
It's like in my mining hometown, the sub-Saharan Africans and Moroccans did great because there were only two families and they were both mining engineers.
Well, you know what? Yeah. So if I remember correctly, there was actually a piece, I want to say in Social Forces, I want to say it might have been in 2007 or 2009 that actually tried to test that Ogbu thesis. But there hasn't been very much empirical work trying to actually put that to the test. So those of you who are listening out there, and those of you looking for a dissertation thesis or for your next book project, I would love, love, love to read that. So,
And just to be clear, I'm not doubting that migrants from former colonial possessions do poorly in receiving countries. I'm just questioning what is the causal mechanism for that. And I would bet that the vast majority of that is mediated by the selectivity gradient.
But can I just add, I mean, I think this was a really interesting discussion, but what's so interesting to me about it also is that, like, this sort of falls apart when we're talking about children of immigrants, right? So, like, so obviously my book is about, like, you know, the context of immigration and, like, the sort of the larger context of immigration from former French colonies, but the people I study are not immigrants themselves. And so I think what's interesting, so that's why I think that's another reason why I think the colonial piece is so important, because these are people who are native French, but they're just not framed that way because of the legacy of the colonial empires.
I was just asking, so what are the coping mechanisms that your subjects used in this feeling of you know, being marginalized, or this feeling like you just can't catch a break, or that the doors are closing to you? Like, what were the coping mechanisms that you saw?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things I think is a bit ironic, thinking about sort of Republican ideology that sort of, you know, disavows kind of group-related identity category, or communities, excuse me, is that because of the sort of shared experiences of marginalization, discrimination that many of my respondents discuss, they actually sort of, you know, have formed communities based on being, you know, of Maghreban origin or being of Algerian origin or Moroccan origin, or these sorts of things. So I think what's happening in France is that these sort of identity-related groups or communities are being created in spite of sort of what Republican ideology, you know, values or would say is better So that part of it is sort of developing part of their coping, to get back to your, specifically to your question, is sort of networking or forming alliances with other Maghreban individuals.
Yeah, yeah, sure. So my question is, to a certain extent, why Maghreb origin French and not sub-Saharan African French, right? Because France has two huge migrant streams, one being from North Africa and one being from sub-Saharan Africa. And, you know, you studied North African descended populations, and Michelle Lamont did the same thing when she wrote her book comparing basically race relations in the United States and those in France. I noticed earlier you said that the French stereotype of North African descended populations is that they don't have sufficient civic nationalism. And, you know, I've heard similar things, and that the French do perceive sub-Saharan African migrants or sub-Saharan descended populations as having plenty of civic nationalism. And so there's kind of a different attitude towards those. But, you know, you're the expert. You've spent much more time there. And so could you contrast both the I mean, I know you focused on Maghreb descended populations, but can you contrast the perceptions, the relations, everything like that, of how French people understand Maghreb descended populations and sub-Saharan descended populations or migrants?
Yeah, I mean, so the answer to sort of the first part of your question, I decided to focus on North African origin individuals primarily because of Michelle Lamont's work, actually. So,
not two independent cases.
Sorry?
I said your study and her study are not two independent cases of, like, both of you looked at it. And yeah, I get it.
Yeah, so I've been interested in sort of issues of, like, race and identity in France for a long time based on living there as an undergrad and various other things. But so when I was sort of thinking about how to think about these questions within France, at least at the time, most of the work was on first-generation immigrants. And so that's how I got interested in second-generation immigrants. And then that's, you know, because I was so familiar with Michelle Lewant's work at the time, that's how I found that particular population. So that's the answer. That's the quick answer to that question. But the second more sort of substantive answer to the question is, I'm really interested more generally in how we can think about markers of racial difference outside of phenotype. So I thought that the North African case was particularly interesting for thinking about that, because
So precisely like I was saying, I couldn't tell the difference, and you're saying that's what makes them interesting.
Yeah I mean, one of the things I think makes them interesting, I mean, I think, you know, oftentimes when I told, you know, when I was in grad school and I was working on this, people would say, oh, well, how much is this about race versus about culture or religion or these other things? Whereas I felt like if I had done something on sub-Saharan African origin immigrants or second generation immigrants, I would have gotten that question, right? So I guess I was sort of thinking about, you know, what is it about being North African that's seen as a distinct ethnic group to people in France without the sort of phenotypical part? Because again, I think race is not the same thing as phenotype, but we often can, you know, use them interchangeably, which bothers me. And so it was also a thing of like, how is this population marked as different? So one way the march is different is, you know, for example, being Muslim, but then, you know, even among my respondents, there's a lot of variation or heterogeneity in how people understand what it means to be Muslim, right? So then it's sort of like, well, you know, maybe it's having a North African origin name. And so my respondents who didn't have, you know, stereotypical or traditional North African kinds of names felt that they received a lot less discrimination than their counterparts that did. So I guess I felt like focusing on that would lead to a more holistic understanding of how difference is actually marked without just relying on sort of phenotypical differences.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.